I'm sorry you feel that way. Take a moment with that sentence. It has the shape of an apology. It starts with, I'm sorry after all. But notice what it's actually doing. It's not addressing anything that was done. It's addressing how someone reacted to what was done. The responsibility has quietly shifted, mid-sentence, from the speaker to the listener. And most of us have heard a version of this so many times that it barely registers anymore. We hear sorry, and some part of us files it under apology received, even when, if you actually look at it, nothing was apologized for at all. I'm Andre Barbouras, and this is The Unlearning Project, a podcast from barbouras.com, where every couple of weeks we take one assumption that usually goes unexamined and we crack it open. Today's assumption is about apologies themselves, specifically the assumption that if something sounds like an apology, it functions like one. And the gap between those two things is bigger and more consequential than it first appears. Let's start by breaking down what an actual apology requires, structurally, because once you see the components, it becomes much easier to spot when they're missing. A genuine apology has, at minimum, three parts. First, an acknowledgement of what happened. Specific, not vague. Second, an acceptance of responsibility for that thing, not for how it was received, not for the broader situation, but for the actual action or decision. And third, some orientation toward repair, not necessarily a grand gesture, but some indication that the person understands what would need to be different going forward. Now, here's the thing about non-apologies. They almost always borrow the language of apology while quietly removing one or more of these components. And because the language is so familiar, the words sorry, regret, apologize are doing a lot of work just by being present. Our brains tend to register the form of an apology even when the function isn't there. It's a bit like recognizing the shape of a key without checking whether it actually fits the lock. Let's go through some of the most common patterns, because once you start categorizing them, you'll likely recognize all of them immediately. The first is the one I opened with. I'm sorry you feel that way. This is sometimes called the conditional apology, and it's probably the most widely recognized non-apology, to the point where it's almost become a cultural joke. But it's worth taking seriously precisely because it's so recognizable and yet still so commonly used. What this phrase does is relocate the problem. The problem is no longer, I did something that caused harm. The problem becomes, you have a feeling, and that feeling is the thing being addressed. It sounds sympathetic. It even sounds, on the surface, like it's centering the other person's experience. But it actually does the opposite. It makes their emotional response the subject of the apology, rather than the action that produced it. And subtly, it implies that the feeling might be a bit of an overreaction. Otherwise, why would it need to be specifically named as the thing being sorry about, rather than the action itself? The second pattern is the passive voice apology. Mistakes were made. It has come to my attention that some people were affected. Notice what's missing here. An actor. Mistakes don't make themselves. Someone made them. But passive voice allows the sentence to exist without a subject, which means the apology can occur without anyone actually being the one apologizing for something they did. It's an apology shaped like a weather report. Things happened. Nobody did them. We can all move on now. The third is what I'd call the apology with a built-in defense. I'm sorry, but you have to understand. I was under a lot of pressure. Or, I shouldn't have said that, but you also... This one is interesting because it often starts with what sounds like the real thing, an acknowledgement, even responsibility. But the but functions as an undo button. Everything before the but gets quietly walked back by everything after it. And often, what comes after the but reframes the situation so that the apologizer becomes, in some way, also a victim of the circumstances, which makes it much harder for the other person to hold on to whatever harm they experienced, because now there's a competing narrative of harm to consider too. The fourth is the apology that's really a request for absolution. I feel terrible about this. I've been beating myself up over it. This one can be genuinely confusing, because the person does seem to be experiencing real distress. But notice where the emotional center of gravity is. It's on the apologizer's suffering, not on the impact of their action. And often, faced with someone who appears to be in genuine pain about what they did, the social pressure shifts toward comforting them, which means the person who was actually harmed ends up, almost without realizing it, taking care of the emotional needs of the person who harmed them. The roles have quietly reversed. So here's the question that I think is actually more interesting than just cataloging these patterns. Why do we keep accepting them? Because most people, if you describe these patterns to them in the abstract, would immediately recognize them as inadequate. And yet, in the moment when one of these is delivered to us directly, we very often accept it. Or at least we don't push back. Why? Part of the answer is social cost. Rejecting an apology, even a clearly inadequate one, requires continuing a conflict that the apology was, on the surface, supposed to be ending. The non-apology often functions as a kind of social signal that says, this conversation should be over now. And pointing out that the apology wasn't real means extending the conflict, which carries its own social risk. You might be seen as someone who can't accept an apology, someone who's holding on to things, someone who's making things harder than they need to be. The non-apology shifts not just responsibility for the original action, but also responsibility for the ongoing discomfort onto the person who didn't get a real apology in the first place. There's also something here that connects to power dynamics, and this is where it gets particularly relevant in workplace and institutional contexts. The quality of apology someone receives, or doesn't, often correlates with their position relative to the person apologizing. A non-apology from someone with more power, directed at someone with less, is harder to challenge, because challenging it means directly confronting a power difference, not just a wrong. Meanwhile, the same non-apology, if it went the other direction, would likely be far less tolerated. This isn't a hard rule, but it's a pattern worth noticing. Non-apologies tend to flow more easily downward than upward, and the social cost of calling them out tends to be higher the further down you are. There's also a more individual, psychological reason we accept these apologies, and it's less about social dynamics and more about our own discomfort with ambiguity. A real apology, fully delivered, creates a kind of closure. Even if the underlying issue isn't fully resolved, there's at least a shared acknowledgement of what happened. A non-apology doesn't create that closure, but it sounds like it should. And so there's often a pull toward treating it as if it created closure, because the alternative is sitting in an unresolved space where something happened, an apology-shaped thing was said in response, and yet nothing actually feels settled. That unresolved space is uncomfortable. Accepting the non-apology, even when some part of us knows it wasn't real, can feel easier than naming that discomfort out loud. I want to be careful here not to suggest that every imperfect apology is a manipulation. People are often genuinely flustered, embarrassed, defensive in the moment. Apologizing well is a skill, and not everyone has had much practice at it, especially in high stakes or emotionally charged situations. The point isn't to treat every "I'm sorry you feel that way" as evidence of bad character. The point is to notice the gap between what an apology sounds like and what it actually does, and to recognize that the gap matters, even when, for all sorts of understandable reasons, we choose not to point it out in the moment. Because here's what happens if that gap goes unnoticed often enough, over time. The form of apology becomes sufficient on its own. Saying sorry becomes the resolution, regardless of what follows it. And once that becomes the norm, in a relationship, in a team, in an organization, accountability quietly detaches from language. People can say all the right words, repeatedly, without anything about the underlying pattern ever needing to change. The words become the repair. And the actual repair, the part where something would need to be different next time, never has to happen at all. So here's what I'd like to leave you with. Think of the last apology you received that didn't quite sit right, one where you couldn't immediately say why, but something about it felt unfinished. Go back to it now and ask, which of the three parts was actually there? The acknowledgement, the responsibility, the orientation toward repair? And if one of them was missing, what would it have taken in that moment to name that gap, instead of quietly accepting the shape of an apology in place of the thing itself? That's it for this episode of the Unlearning Project. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another one. Until then, listen a little more closely to the apologies you hear and the ones you give.